Coming up, Lucky Severson reports on the ethical questions surrounding genome sequencing or finding a child's entire genetic makeup. Who should be tested and how much should parents be told? And I talk with Grammy Award-winning artist Bobby McFerrin about faith and the transcendent power of music.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Kim Lawton, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. Muslims around the world celebrated the end of Ramadan with Eid al-Fitr, one of their most important holidays. The festival was observed with special prayers and elaborate feasts to break the month-long daytime fasting. But in some areas, the holiday was marred by continuing violence and threats of violence. Fighting continued in Syria, where civilians prayed for an end to the two-year conflict. Meanwhile, Syrian friends of a prominent Italian priest, Father Paolo Dall'Olio, confirmed that he had been abducted inside Syria more than a week ago. The internationally known priest went missing as he tried to mediate a rift between Kurds and Islamists. There were widespread calls for his release. There were also renewed calls for the release of two Orthodox archbishops who were kidnapped in Syria more than 100 days ago. There's been no information about their whereabouts, and church leaders say they're frustrated by the lack of international attention. The temporary closing because of terror threats of 19 U.S. embassies across the Mideast, Africa, and Asia this week highlighted the complex nature of diplomatic work in some of the world's major hotspots. Among the challenges, critics have long charged that the U.S. government hasn't done a good enough job in acknowledging the role of religion in foreign policy. At a State Department ceremony on Wednesday, Secretary of State John Kerry officially launched a new Office of Faith-Based Community Initiatives, which he said would help build better relationships with religious leaders and organizations in the U.S. and abroad.
Its mission is as clear as it is compelling. It is to engage more closely with faith communities around the world with the belief that we need to partner with them to solve global challenges. And there is an enormous partnership, I believe, there for the asking.
Kerry spoke of his personal interest in religion and said he has high hopes this office can play a crucial role in U.S. diplomacy.
We need to recognize that in a world where people of all faiths are migrating and mingling like never before, where we are this global community, which we always talk about, we ignore the global impact of religion, in my judgment, at our peril.
Heading the office is Christian ethicist Sean Casey, who is taking a leave from Wesley Theological Seminary. Casey said the office will observe the lines between church and state.
We will ensure that our engagement efforts will be consistent with the United States Constitution and other laws, both in terms of the spirit and letter of the law.
After the ceremony, I asked him to outline specific areas where he sees his team being effective.
The public and political impact of lived religion across the planet is huge. It's almost impossible to measure. It's so large. So if we're going to be promoting human rights, if we're going to be doing development, if we're going to be trying to build for peace and mitigate conflict, we have to understand the religious dimensions of all of those sectors. And frankly, in the past, we probably haven't had the capacity we should have in our diplomacy.
And he said they will not shy away from addressing the places where religion is part of the problem.
So it's not just dealing with the good religious people and ignoring the negative aspects of religion and politics. So it's going to be very dicey. It's going to be very complicated. And we have to have some sophistication about how to engage, particularly in those areas where religion may be a source of conflict.
In other news, humanitarian officials are sounding the alarm about the impact of a massive drought in the sub-Saharan nation of Namibia. UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Agency, said more than 100,000 children there are at risk of malnutrition. Namibia is suffering its worst drought in 30 years, with women and children bearing the brunt of it. The country's president has declared a state of national emergency. At the Vatican, Pope Francis continued urging Catholics to reject consumerism. Again this week, he said wealth doesn't bring true happiness. Some conservative Catholics are voicing concern that Francis doesn't spend enough time publicly condemning abortion. But prominent Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley defended the Pope, saying the emphasis on love and compassion provides the context for the Church's stand against abortion. He said, quote, "We oppose abortion not because we're mean and old-fashioned, but because we love people, and that is what we must show the world." We have a report today on the ethics of genome sequencing, finding out a child's entire genetic makeup. That could reveal defects that might cause disease or disabilities later in life. But should doctors tell parents everything they find out? Would parents even want to know? Lucky Severson has our story.
This is Liam. Everybody likes Liam. Hard not to. That smile under the hat he never takes off. And this is his loving mom, Kathleen Hilferty, who knew from the beginning that something was terribly wrong with Liam.
I knew something was wrong because the breathing, he couldn't eat at the same time. He couldn't drink and breathe at the same time.
Liam is 12. This is his twin brother, Joseph, who is about twice as big as Liam. From day one, his mother was desperate to find out exactly what was wrong with Liam so she could get him treated.
I wanted to at least have a name to it so I could say I did the best possible thing for my child or I gave him the best possible care.
For 12 agonizing years, Kathleen was looking for an answer and recently got one from Dr. Ian Krantz at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, who had sequenced Liam's genome.
And we not only found an answer in him, but we found the same answer in a number of other children. And we have a new diagnosis. We're understanding it, how to treat it better.
The discovery of Liam's genetic defect underscores how rapidly and how important the science of sequencing the human genome has become in modern medicine, especially when it comes to children.
When researchers first mapped the human genome, it took almost 10 years and cost $3 billion. That was less than 10 years ago. Today, the process takes 3 weeks, and the price tag is rapidly approaching $1,000.
Nancy Spinner heads the Division of Genomic Diagnostics at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
For parents whose kids have some serious birth defects or congenital abnormalities, you really want to understand what's causing it. You want to know, is there something that you should be doing? I think moms feel very guilty because when they have a child with a birth defect, then they say, was it something I did in the pregnancy?
Dr. Krantz and Nancy Spinner are a husband and wife team who are the principal investigators of federally funded research to help develop guidelines for doctors and patients. Unlike earlier genetic tests, sequencing the genome reveals a child's entire genetic makeup, including their predisposition to disease that might occur later in life. And it raises some ethical questions. What should parents know, and what knowledge might cause more pain than gain?
Now we're looking across the entire genome, and we have this enormous challenge. How much of it should we report back? What should we tell people? How are they going to use the information?
The problem we're having now is there are no guidelines to say what should be reported back, who should be tested, who shouldn't be tested.
Who should be told?
Who should be told about this information exactly? We're very good at diagnosing and not so great at treating genetic disorders or preventing things from happening later in life. But I think knowledge is powerful, and having information can, in the short term, affect parental decisions, reproductive decisions. It can affect lifestyle choices later on.
There have already been examples of people who have been tested, seen a predisposition to diabetes, and start to immediately get screened for it and find out that they have diabetes much earlier. That can save many dollars in healthcare costs because you can treat things before they become bad.
Scientists say that for diseases diagnosed early and then treated, sequencing can indeed save lives. But should doctors tell parents when tests show that their child will eventually fall victim to early adult onset disease, like Alzheimer's, for which there is no known cure?
And we've already seen some cases where we find some things that are damaging that tell you that you're at very, very high risk for an adult onset disorder that's going to be bad. And we can't, and there's no treatment, so we can't really think of a reason to give that information to people. And I think right now we're trying to learn what should we be giving and what shouldn't we be giving. Because our main goal is not to cause any harm or additional stress to families.
The Hunter family in New Jersey wanted any information they could get about their 14-year-old daughter, Amanda. She suffers from Crohn's disease and serious cognitive impairment, and her condition appeared to be regressing. Like all children, Amanda's genome contains 22,000 genes to hold tantalizing information that could save or prolong her life. Her mother, Lori, wanted some answers.
I love that people are able to say it is what it is until you're living in that world. And that motherly instinct tells you something's not right. You're going to stop at nothing until you find out what you can do to help that child.
What if you test for one thing and find something else? When Amanda's genome was sequenced, doctors discovered what they call an incidental finding, something they weren't looking for, a deletion, 7 genes missing from a chromosome. The deletion didn't explain her impairment, but it indicated she was susceptible to cancer. And then her mom got some news that may have saved her life.
When Amanda was diagnosed with that deletion, the natural course is to test the parents. So her father and I were tested, and it turned out that I carry that same deletion. So I've gone through the same series of tests. I had a full-body MRI. They found a lesion just above my diaphragm.
It's a slow-growing cancer and treatable if detected early enough.
When they told me that what they found had no explanation for the issues I was concerned about, my immediate reaction was, I wish that I hadn't known. But now, yes, I am glad, because the condition is a cancer, you know, can cause cancerous tumors. The tumors must be surgically removed in order to avoid further complications. And I want to be here for my children. I need to be here for my children.
She gave birth to her second daughter, Kaylin, after undergoing an amniocentesis, which erroneously showed that Kaylin was normal. Lori knew the first week that Kaylin was not normal, and after doctors sequenced her genome, she learned that Kaylin has a rare, non-hereditary disease called Wolff-Hirschhorn's syndrome. Her 4-year-old son Ryan's genome has also been sequenced, and he appears to be in good health. For some parents, gaining knowledge of their children's genome before they are born would help them be better prepared in case their child has special needs. But it will undoubtedly encourage some parents to choose abortion.
We have some patients who we have followed who have used it for prenatal diagnosis in such a way to avoid having affected children.
Dr. Krantz and Nancy Spinner are most concerned that the science has few guidelines, including safeguards for patients' privacy.
We live in a capitalistic society. Often when something is technically feasible and fiscally feasible, it is offered, and there are for-profit companies now who are offering this testing to the individual. So you can go out yourself and pay the money and get your genome sequenced. The problem now is it's the $1,000 genome, but it's the $1 million interpretation, because you can get the sequence, but understanding what it does takes hundreds of hours of manpower to interpret and understand, and we're not even that good at it.
As for Dr. Krantz and his wife Nancy and their 3 children,
I have to say, neither Nancy or I or anyone in our family has had their genome sequenced yet. And not because we wouldn't be interested, but I don't think we really subscribe to the recreational sequencing of genomes. But if there was a medical concern, I don't think we would hesitate.
For Kathleen, even though the news about Liam was not good, just knowing seems to have made a huge difference.
I guess a miracle, I would say, because I waited so long. And as he's getting sicker, I didn't want him to pass away, because then I would feel so guilty that I didn't do everything I could have. Now that I have a name, I know there's no cure for him, but he can help so many other kids.
It's the promise of help for kids like Liam that drives the science that is going so fast, the roadmap with guidelines and warning signs can't keep up. And as the technology progresses, the ethical issues will become even more difficult. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Grammy Award-winning artist Bobby McFerrin is probably best known for his 1980s feel-good hit, Don't Worry, Be Happy. But he's also a composer and a conductor who has released albums in a variety of genres. He's delving into religious music with his most recent project, Spiritual. It includes traditional African-American spirituals and original devotional songs. I spoke with him about music and faith. Ten-time Grammy Award-winning artist Bobby McFerrin believes music has a transcendent spiritual power.
It elicits so many emotions. Have you ever listened to a piece of music and for some reason which you just can't understand, you simply burst into tears? Music has a way of communicating in a way that language does not. It can go past language.
In his concerts, the genre-blending artist is known for his unique style of wordless improvisations, using his voice and his body as accompanying instruments.
I'm not so much into people being wowed over my technique or what I can do, stuff like that. That's just a vehicle for me. That's just a vehicle for my spirit.
McFerrin says his Christian faith permeates everything he does, but it's particularly evident in his new album, Spiritual, which includes his interpretation of classic African-American spirituals and several devotional songs that he wrote. The project honors the legacy of his father, Robert McFerrin Sr., the first African-American to sing a title role at the Metropolitan Opera. The senior McFerrin also released an album of spirituals, Deep River, in 1957.
I never heard my father pray. I know that he got on his knees many times before I went to bed at night and prayed. But I always heard him pray whenever he sang these spirituals.
Every time I feel the spirit.
McFerrin says songs like Every Time I Feel the Spirit still resonate today.
I certainly try to pray them as I'm singing them. That's important. And the hope is that when people hear these pieces, that they'll carry them home with them, and then they'll inspire them to begin a spiritual journey or to continue on it.
McFerrin, whose grandfather was a Baptist minister, grew up in the Episcopal Church.
When I was 16, I wanted to become a monk.
A Catholic monk?
An Anglican monk in the Anglican Church, Episcopal Church. I was very attracted to the life of quiet, structure.
I was helpless, I was hopeless, to Jesus he made it good.
He says he gave up on the idea in his early 20s when he realized he was meant to be a singer, but the religious impulses remain.
I'm still a very quiet guy, and I love the scriptures. I still read the Bible through, you know, over and over and over again, because you always find things there, you know, that you hadn't seen before. I could read the same verse 1,000 times, but the 1,001st time I read it, I'll find something in it that I hadn't seen before.
McFerrin says when he's not traveling, he attends an Episcopal church, but he doesn't like narrow labels.
Fix me, Jesus. Fix me.
I don't really think of myself as a religious person, per se, but more of a spiritual person who follows Christ, who follows Jesus as my spiritual master.
Don't worry. Be happy.
The 63-year-old musician is perhaps best known for his 1988 a cappella hit, Don't Worry, Be Happy. In subsequent years, he's conducted classical orchestras and released albums featuring styles from across the musical spectrum. He frequently works with young people, trying to help them see the power of music as well. It's a lesson he says he learned at an early age.
My mother knew all about this when I was very young. She knew how music was a healing balm. Because whenever I was sick, she'd give me two things. She'd give me medicine for my aches and pains, and she'd give me music for my spirit. There have been times when I've walked on stage ill, not thinking that I could actually go on and do my performance, and 90 minutes later, walk off stage well. music does have incredible power to rearrange your insides, you know, rearrange your thoughts, heal your body.
McFerrin says he sees the spiritual all around him.
Just being is a religious experience. It's a spiritual experience. Just being is holy.
The Lord is my shepherd.
McFerrin's favorite book in the Bible is the Psalms. Several years ago, he wrote a song based on Psalm 23. But in his version, the love of God takes on a feminine form.
She rights my wrongs.
The song has been adopted by choirs across the country, including this one called Singing Quaker Women Plus Other Faithful Friends. McFerrin says the song was inspired after he and his choir were rehearsing in a church and began discussing the many male images in the Bible.
This seemed to make sense. You know, people forget, you know, a father's love, and then there's a mother's love, which complements the father's love, and they fit together, you know, nicely. So that's why I wrote it.
The new album has a song he wrote based on Psalm 25, verse 15.
Well, you know the mind.
Spiritual also includes another feminine reference to God.
She's got the whole world in her hands.
In his concerts, such as this one at St. Louis's Sheldon Concert Hall, McFerrin always encourages the audience to sing along, often pulling people up on the stage to join him.
I like to think that regardless of how you come into the concert hall at the beginning, you'll leave differently. You know, I think that's part of my job description as an artist, is moving people to make important changes in their life.
Another part of his job description, he says, is moving people to joy.
If there's any one thing I want, it's for people to feel that sense of joy, the joy that I feel just being able to sing. You know, and getting a room full of strangers to sing together, what a joyful experience that is for me. I love it.
I'm leaning on your arm, yes indeed, Lord.
McFerrin says he believes God speaks through his music, but he says that doesn't make him unique.
God doesn't speak through me and not through you for some reason. He speaks to everyone, and we in turn can open up our mouths or open up our hands or our minds or whatever, our professions, and let God speak through us to other people.
Let God in your neighbor be at rest.
Yeah, my father used to say, the Lord has entrusted me with a talent. It's not my gift. The Lord has entrusted me with a talent. And I absolutely feel that way, that he's given me this gift to share with other people, to uplift hearts.
I feel better, so much better, since I let my burden down.
He says while his new album comes out of his Christian faith, he hopes those of other faiths and no faith will indeed be uplifted by its spirit. Tributes flooded in this week for Robert Bella, the prominent sociologist of religion who died at the age of 86. The longtime professor at the University of California, Berkeley, was widely respected for his study of the role of religion in public life, and particularly America's tradition of civil religion. Among his best-known works was the influential Habits of the Heart, first published in 1985 and still required reading in numerous university programs. Finally, on our calendar, on August 15th, Japanese Buddhists observe Obon, a festival honoring the spirits of ancestors. Also on August 15th, Roman Catholics celebrate the Assumption of the Virgin Mary, when they believe Mary, at the end of her life on earth, was assumed into heaven, body and soul. And there are more Mary celebrations this week in Carthage, Missouri, where tens of thousands of mostly Vietnamese Catholics gathered for the Marian Days Festival, where they offer thanks for the freedom they have in America. That's our program for now. I'm Kim Lawton. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, where I'd love to connect with you as well. Watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website, where there's always much more, including audio and video podcasts of this program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more music from Bobby McFerrin.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Be more. PBS.